This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 397 for October 27 of 2017. The new Honda Accord, it's scary good. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai, better drives us.
Whoa!
Very scary,
Gary. We've got a Halloween theme going.
Boy,
here.
This is very, very unusual.
Well, I got a hats off to Carmen and Katie.
Yeah.
They came up with all the idea.
This whole thing.
I like it.
And there's more to come.
And there's more to come later in the show. Exactly right. And we're not going to explain that just yet. But we will tell everybody. We got Sharon Carty from Automotive News with us. And it's great to have you back here, Sharon.
Thanks for inviting me.
Okay. But our special guest for the first half of the show is Ray Mikitchik. He is the Assistant Vice President for Honda Sales at American Honda. And Ray, it's great to have you here in the studio.
Thanks for having me, John. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so we're going to devote this quarter hour to talking to you, and then we've got Don Marna coming in later to talk about the manufacturing of the Accord. But let's talk Accord.
Yeah, and he brought an Accord with him.
Yeah.
Brought one here. Yeah, that's great. Looks good.
Has it gone on sale yet?
It has. October 18th, we started.
Okay, so it's still early, but what's the reaction?
Yeah, you know, it's a relatively modest target this month. About 3,500 units of the 18 is where we're trying to get to. We still got some 17s to sell. Mm-hmm. But the early reaction has been absolutely fabulous to the car. We're so excited and proud of what has happened with the new Accord. So.
Great, Ray, didn't anybody tell you that nobody's buying midsize sedans anymore? Didn't
you know, we've heard about that. I think I've read some of that in some of your articles over the years. But
you guys don't have that problem. Other car companies are struggling with passenger cars. You guys don't seem to have an issue.
Well, we've been very fortunate to have some really great designs. And, you know, Honda really is a passenger car company. That's where we started our roots. And the Accord is no exception to that. I mean, the Honda Accord is really a brand unto itself in the midsize segment. In fact, I think the Honda Accord, if it was its own brand, would outsell 30 other brands in the United States. So we do very, very well with this product and are super excited. This is the biggest reimagining of Accord in our history, and it's a beautiful car.
So 10th generation, so you guys have some practice at doing this.
We've done it a couple of times before since 1976, right? So it's a little bit of history.
What are customers looking for now, you think, that makes this stand out from the past generations?
Well, I think, you know, our packaging is really designed to give a very stylistic approach to design and technology and fuel economy. What Accord is really about is about being a great package, fun to drive, efficient, high tech, and that's all the things that we believe we've brought with this new 2018 model.
Okay, we got a question from the audience here. Kevin Hissel, who apparently owns a 16 Accord, 2016.
Okay.
Says, went to the dealer, no 2-liter turbo. Why the delay?
Yeah, there's no delay. It's just a matter. We have two different lines at Marysville that build this vehicle. So the plan all along has been 1.5, starts out at October 18th. And then in late November, we'll see the 2-liter.
So you're still ramping up.
Yeah, just ramping up. And then the hybrid, 2-liter hybrid, comes after the first of the year. Mm-hmm. So just really a plan.
Ray, talk about the styling of this car, because I've talked with you about this before when it was at launch time. To me, this is the most handsome-looking Accord. It looks to me like you guys really put more of an emphasis on styling than you ever have before.
Yeah, I think, John, you know, we sort of pushed the wheels out to the corners. We've thinned out the A-pillars. We've got a longer, slopier hood. So it just gives us the packaging with the 2-liter and 1.5-liter turbos gives us the ability to do things a little bit differently. I mean, this has 2 inches more legroom in the rear seat than the previous car, and that was pretty much class-leading legroom at that time in the 16, 17 model. So,
and you didn't take it out of the front seat?
No, the front seat is spacious. spacious and comfortable, but it's a very slopey kind of a design, sort of a coupe-like design in a four-door sedan package. So, you know, styling's in the eye of the beholder, but we love the car.
So who demographically will be purchasing this car?
Well, that's the thing about Accord. It's amazing. It runs the gamut of who buys a vehicle in the United States, right? We see a lot of young people, particularly buying the sport trim. So Civic and Accord are some of the highest purchased vehicles amongst millennial buyers. And then we see older consumers. And we think we'll see people coming down from near luxury brands or luxury brands to look at the Accord because of the way the package is and the realities of the sedan business these days.
I heard you guys are getting making some inroads in with the Hispanic market as well. Do you know why?
Well, because we're marketing to that consumer. I mean, it's a huge growth opportunity in the United States. Last year, as a matter of fact, in 2016, pretty much all of our growth could be attributed to the Hispanic consumer for the American Honda.
Wow.
So we are marketing to the Hispanic consumer. Hispanic consumers like style, value, comfort, reliability, just like everybody else does. So I think if any of the multicultural markets, if you just basically take the time to talk to that consumer, you see some success, and we're working very hard to do that.
You mentioned, you know, quality and reliability. Now, those seem to be hallmarks of Honda and Accord in particular. Does that matter to consumers, or is it something that they just take for granted?
Well, I think it always does matter to consumers. I guess the way I look at it from being an old retail guy, right, is when I look at the wholesale values, the used car values of Hondas in particular, we hold a premium. And so I think consumers understand that they're willing to pay more for the historic reliability and quality aspects that Honda has done such a great job, whether it be automobiles or power equipment or motorcycles or jets, whatever it is. We tend to have a real strong brand in the DQR area.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we got another question here from Nick Mav. I hope I say this right, Nick. Mavrogenis. He says he's got a 2008 through 2012 generation Accord with a ski pass-through in the back seats. This dude's like me. He's got a couple of cross-country skis from March through November. He puts them in, but he wants to know, why does not the new Accord have a ski pass-through?
I think it's got the fold-down seats, right,
yeah.
But no pass-through. You know, that would be one for Don later on. You could talk about the design a little more than I can.
Okay.
I couldn't tell you why we made that choice. I just don't know.
Okay.
It is a popular thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it'd be able to put your skis inside. I know that.
Yeah.
Especially up here in Michigan.
Especially.
Don't get that as much in L.A.
Yeah. No. That's right.
So talk to us about what it is that you guys had as the brief in terms of, you know, you told the designers and engineers in order for this to be a successful product in the segment, we need this, this, and this. I mean, what are some of those things?
Yeah, I think really, Gary, what we're looking for is gorgeous styling. Right? You know, you got to have gorgeous styling we have to stand out. We proved that with the Civic. With the Civic, the styling of that package has been wildly accepted by all the consumers in the United States and abroad. And so you got to have that at first. You have to have cutting edge technology, right? We love to have a fun to drive package. Honda has always been known for the fun to drive factor of our products. And so I think, and then technology, you know, technology's got to be in there. It's got to be cutting edge.
So you have Honda Sensing on this, that standard.
Throughout the entire lineup, Honda Sensing, that's correct, yeah. So that's our best safety packaging right now. It's an incredible suite of driver assist technologies really designed to make the car more safe. I mean, we have a goal of no crashes, right? Mm-hmm. That's what we'd like to see happen in this world is no more traffic accidents.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to continue to work towards that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that your growth is coming from the Hispanic market. How are you going to market this car differently, or are you?
You know, we create unique campaigns for every launch. I think Honda's had a history of having sort of a different way of marketing our products, and the Accord television and digital creative will be no exception. I think those commercials hit for the first time this weekend, actually, so I'm excited to seeing those with all the people as I watch my college and NFL football this weekend. So
you put knobs back in the Accord.
Knobs are a big hit. When we talked about the knobs at the dealer meeting, we got a standing ovation.
Really? So,
I think one of the things that we may have just gone a little too far in the touchscreen realm as an industry, and everybody said, you know, how many buttons do you need to have? And we're counting buttons on the dash, and we said we can do an iPad type thing and take all the buttons away. But you know what? We've got both a volume knob and a tuning knob in the Accord. So wildly popular with our constituency for sure.
Bravo.
Thank you.
But who would have ever imagined that that would be something that people would get excited about or long for, right? I mean, it was always like, oh, where's the knob? Where's the knob? And I mean, even though you always had it on the steering wheel that you could you could adjust the volume and change the stations and what mode you were in, but still, there's something to be said for that.
The idea was redundancy, right? You'd have, you know, the voice opportunity and then the dash and on the steering wheel. Well, now we have another option, which is the good old-fashioned knob, and that seems to be wildly popular. But I didn't have anything to do with designing it, that's for sure. I just get to sell what they give me, so.
Some things are worth keeping, even if they're 100 years old. And a knob is just so easy and intuitive that, you know, why give it up?
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so, you know, we're talking about the sedan, midsize sedan market not being particularly robust in general. As John said, you guys are doing well. So is it coincidence that Camry came out all new when Accord comes out all new? I mean, was that just a fluke of the calendar?
You know, it's interesting. I think we all share a similar cadence. You know, we're on a five-year cycle with passenger cars. Toyota is, sure, I is as well. I think it is an impact on the segment, though, that when you see the two biggest selling vehicles be either 5 years old or brand new, you know, you're going to have a different impact on what the industry does. So, you know, we believe that we're going to see very robust sales with this car as we did with the previous generation Accord. I mean, it's the best-selling car in the segment on a retail basis right now. Mm-hmm. So I believe that'll put a halo on the whole segment, and we'll see lift again because there's nothing inherently wrong with a passenger car or a midsize sedan. I mean, I don't know. Mm-hmm.
So deaths of the segment are greatly exaggerated.
Yeah, exactly. I think we're, you know, I think we said earlier. I mean, the Accord alone would outsell 30 plus brands in the United States in the automotive space. I mean, so that's certainly nothing to sneeze at. I mean, I challenge most people to name 30 brands in the automotive space, but they know the Honda Accord.
Hey, Kevin Hissel also asked a question that I know you've been asked this a million times, but I'm sure the audience wants to hear the answer. He says he loves Lane Watch. So as you know, if you put on the right-hand turn signal, the center screen in the dashboard would show a rear-view mirror looking back, and people flipped over that thing. They loved that. It was, you know, people would point at and go, look at that. But you dropped it for this car, and he wants to know why.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, I spent quite a bit of time at our sister division, Acura, right? And we've had the blind spot indicator system over there for a long time. And I find it much more effective, frankly, once you get used to the idea that you turn the signal on, it beeps, lets you know if there's somebody in your blind spot. I don't have to take my eyes off the road to look at a dashboard. But I will tell you, the customers love the idea of I push the button on the turn signal and I get to see what's in my right side lane. But the BSI system we consider to be more sophisticated, sort of a class above in terms of segment appeal, and much more effective because it shows all the way around the car.
Not just
the right side, but the left side,
yeah,
too.
Right.
And we tried playing with Lane Watch to look at the left side, but people just don't. It isn't intuitive to look to your left and look to your right. It just doesn't work. So the BSI is actually a better system, and there's no reason to do them both.
Right. Of course, Beta was a better system, too, and it didn't work. VHS won out.
Everybody's got BSI.
Yeah. No, you're right.
Wait, now
you're
right. Now DVDs are going away.
That's exactly right.
Streaming.
So, you know, you mentioned that you're bringing people in from different categories, perhaps. You guys also have the CR-V, which is wildly successful. Do you see any cannibalization with this all-new vehicle?
You mean, do I think that I'm going to have trouble selling CRVs because we got a great new Accord?
Or you'll sell fewer CRVs, or I guess it'd be a good problem to have either way.
It's a good problem to have either way. I'm truly blessed to have, you know, a best-selling Civic, a best-selling CRV, and a best-selling Accord. I mean, It's a great time to be the head of sales at Honda, that's for sure. The product is you know, over 2 years, we've done full model changes in all three of our major core products that represent over a million sales a year. Mm-hmm. So I think what we have is a great choice for anybody who wants to choose a product in any one of those three segments. And also many other segments, obviously, with full-size SUVs and minivans and all those other things. So. Mm-hmm.
We've got time for one more question here. Okay. For this segment. Skip Knightem says he wants to understand the reasons why the Accord moved to a CVT transmission.
I think the CVT offers a nice package for that, you know, the mainstream public, right? The 1.5 comes with the CVT, the 1.5 turbo, and that's going to be 75, roughly, percent of our sales. And then we have our all-new 10-speed automatic, which is available in the 2.0T. And so that appeals to a different customer. Perhaps it's more concerned about the performance orientation. I mean, our head of PR, Sage Marie, always says, I'll always take the bigger engine. Yeah. He's a race guy, right?
Yeah, right?
But there's a lot of people who really, I mean, the 1.5 performs so well with that CVT. And honestly, I take it from you guys more than me. The comments that we read in the press as you explored this vehicle was that it's a pretty solid package in the CVT.
And then you got to say, you guys are offering a manual transmission, which, you know, the guys at Car and Driver are just all over the moon about.
Also,
and,
a sweet drive, whether it's the 1.5 or the 2.0, it's the MTs are a lot of fun.
Yeah. And I would add, too, that in all the test driving I do, CVTs, and I'm an enthusiast, I'm not an enthusiast for CVTs, but man, do they deliver the real world fuel economy.
Yeah.
It really does work.
Yeah, we get better MPG and we need to.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, Ray, thanks so much for stopping by.
Hey,
it's been
terrific for
talking
me.
With you. We've got to take a quick break right now. We're going to give a shout-out to our friends at Hyundai, but we're going to come back and talk more about the manufacturing of the new Accord. We're back, and now we're going to be talking with Don Warnock, who's the plant program leader on the 2018 Accord. And, Don, great to have you here.
Oh, thank you.
So how long have you guys been building this now?
So we started mass production September 18th, and we've got about 31,000 units under our belt right now.
How's it going? How's the launch going?
It's going well. Our ramp up's been nice. We're glad of how it's going.
Now, Honda's always had the reputation of being able to do model changeovers on the fly, you know, as opposed to, say, like the domestic Detroit automakers. They'll shut down for several months, and then, boom, they'll kick up and try to nail line speed as fast as possible. Are you guys still doing this sort of running change?
Yeah, so with this model, we ran 30 empty carriers between the last 17 model and the next 18 model.
That was your shutdown.
That was our shutdown. So it was like 30 empty carriers.
It's like 30 minutes. Right?
30 minutes.
And that was it.
That was it.
So how did you do that? I mean, it's just like, because you have all that different tooling that's necessary to build this. I mean, it's different dimensionally than the outgoing model.
It takes years of planning. I mean, we started like 3 years ago with making changes within the plant. Mm-hmm. I mean, this model within our manufacturing plant in Marysville, $220 million investment. Mm-hmm. And our weld shop basically new from the ground up. And we did this all without really shutting down.
How?
So
this is on weekends and stuff like that?
Weekends, holidays, sometimes throughout the shift, throughout the week. You know, it's like close this line down, clear the line out, pour new concrete, install new robots, all within while we're making cars on both
lines. That is unreal. That's amazing.
Two lines within Marysville Auto Plant.
Wow.
So we did this twice, basically.
And I'm sure that you had to keep the production numbers up for the 17 model because, I mean, that was still selling very well, and you couldn't say, well, you know, we'll get to that later.
And you guys don't run a lot of overtime, do you?
No, not a lot of overtime.
So you didn't have to run a bunch of overtime to build up inventory of the 17.
No.
You just That's pretty impressive, let me tell you. That's not easy, people, what they're doing, and not other companies do this.
So, I mean, one of the things that a manufacturing thing that I find interesting is that you guys are using laser brazing on the roof. So talk to us about that and what that means in terms of what you guys have to do and what it provides.
So as far as that technology, we're the first Honda plant in North America to do it. And it's not easy by any means, especially in a large volume factory.
Mm-hmm. So instead of spot welds, boom, 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 this is a continuous beam.
I mean, basically the roof and the side panel has a V shape, and we're laying a wire, and then we're coming in with the laser braze and melting that wire. So parts accuracy, the accuracy of the vehicle as it goes through our weld department, I mean, that's what makes that happen consistently.
So you have to have the stampings made precisely,
exactly.
So they fit together really well,
right.
And then you fill that in with the wire that's melted by a laser,
yes.
And then you have a smooth joint across there, so you don't have to put a strip in there to...
We have a polishing process after the brazing, just to kind of to smooth it out and get that nice finish.
So. And that's, I was going to ask that. You need more metal finish afterwards?
Not much. I mean, it's all done within our cycle time, within our weld department, so it's not much.
And it's mainly done for styling, right? You get rid of that ditch joint and the rubber gasket that's got to go.
Styling, it allows me a little bit lower roof line, and it looks really nice going down the road, so... It was hard. Don't get me wrong.
It was difficult. When it was suggested to you guys, I mean, did you say, guys, wait a minute, you know, it's...
Manufacturing?
Yeah.
I'll be honest, as manufacturing, we pushed back to design side.
Yeah.
It was a lot of risk, we felt. Mm-hmm. But eventually, we came around and we accepted it. And then our team really bought into it. Mm-hmm. And, I can't tell you the countless hours in our weld department, our associates... working on that technology and bring it to fruition. So,
is there anything else you guys are doing that you feel like is really new and cutting edge on this car?
So we're applying within our weld department high performance adhesive. It just provides for a little bit more of a rigid ride. We're also within our paint department, we introduced a couple new colors. Our stamping department, a lot of challenges with this model with the deep draws and everything, the aluminum hood. So basically, almost every part of our process, manufacturing, whether it's paint, weld, assembly, has had some change point that's happened for this model.
Yeah, two things that you said I think are a mouthful. Number one, structural adhesives. Honda has never really used it before.
Right.
You guys are like the last to the party or one of the last to the party on that. But the A-pillars, and Ray talked about this, are very thin.
Yes.
And my understanding is you've got I don't know how to describe it, a different kind of hot stamping approach.
Yeah, there's hot stamps.
Hot stamping, but different parts of the steel are heated at different temperatures.
Yeah.
That's got to be
crazy
to control.
So it creates some challenges for our weld department. You know, with the adhesive, for example, we have about 15 meters of high-strength adhesive throughout this car. And then also we have the acoustical foam for the NVH. And that was a first for the Accord.
And that's injected into hollow parts?
Yeah, the front and rear pillars and the B pillar.
So, you know, you're talking about the stamping. So how much of the sheet metal, exterior sheet metal, do you guys do in-house?
So 100% of the exterior sheet metal.
Wow.
I mean, the side panel, the fenders,
right.
The bonnet, the trunk. All the skins are in-house.
You know, because it's sort of interesting when we look at a car and you see these crisp lines on there and you know, the very, very precision, that it's hard to conceive when you realize that that's just made out of steel, that somebody had to form into that and make it consistently. So from the tail lamp all the way up to the front of the car, it's one continuous line without any hiccups anywhere. That's just incredible.
Yeah, it was those lines are challenging, but our safety department's done a great job with perfecting those die sets.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a question here from Kevin Ferrer. I don't know how to say these names, but he says he's surprised to hear that the Accord Hybrid has the same cargo room and fold-down seats as the non-hybrid version. He wants to know, what compromises did you have to make? Where's the battery, and does the hybrid run down the same line?
So, actually, it does run down the same line. The hybrid runs down our number one line, and the battery component is underneath the rear seat. So we didn't lose anything in the cargo area. And really, that space underneath the rear seat, there's no impact at all. I mean, you won't notice it. You won't notice the height of the seat change. So our design group, they really fulfilled the packaging to get that packaged in that space that we had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know part of it, the power controller was, power electronics were moved up under the hood. The battery's smaller, even though it's the same power, and the gas tank is actually a little bit smaller.
I mean,
to be able to get all that packaging in it.
For our weld departments, it's basically one part change in the rear seat area.
Now, has the Accord always been built at Marysville?
The Accord has always been built at Marysville, and we're very proud of that fact. Mm-hmm.
Because other things have come in there and gone out, but the Accord is just...
It's always been built at Marysville. Mm-hmm.
You know, what's also interesting is that the engines for this come from Anna, Ohio, which is literally down the road from
down
where you're
road,
at.
Yes.
And the 10-speed from Russell's Point, Ohio, or is it the CVT?
It's from the 10AT is from HPPG, which is our plant in Georgia.
Okay, Georgia, yeah.
And then CVT is from our plant in Russell's Point.
It's quite interesting that you guys have all that capability in a fairly contained area, with the exception of the one down in Georgia. Yeah. But a whole lot of companies don't have that anymore.
Joe Pastor wants to know, speaking of production in the plant, did you move out TLX production to make room for the Accord?
No, within, like I said before, our line one, they actually build a TLX, ILX, and then in the Accord. Our line two is 100% Accord. So we didn't move any production from the Marysville Auto Plant.
So how many cars a year does your plant build?
So the capacity is about 440,000 a year.
Wow.
Now, if we need more, then we have opportunities to work overtime for more.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, going back to that whole overtime thing, you guys don't run a lot of overtime, I think, for two reasons. Number one, your build schedule is very predictable.
Right.
And what? A lot of overtime work wears out people and wears out equipment.
Yeah, I mean, if demand's there, we'll supply the demand. I mean, it is that simple. But we try to make everything in core time.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, you guys have an extensive amount of ultra-high-strength steel as well as high-strength steel. More than half of it is high-strength steel. Does that challenge stamping and welding? Is that material an issue, or have you guys worked that out?
I don't believe it's an issue for our stamping department. Our welding department, it's not really an issue. It's just where we get the hot stamp steel and everything is something we're really glad to be conscious of. But as far as the stamping department, it's just business, normal business. Maturing the die sets.
So you've made a ton of changes in the plant. You must have gone through a lot of training with it. Everything seems to be going pretty smoothly. What's keeping you up at night about it?
So we're still in the process. We got to launch yet the 2.0 that everybody's waiting on, and that'll be coming soon. And then the hybrid model would be later on following that. So we still have a little bit more to do related to the 18 model Accord. And then, you know, we always do reflections on how we can improve. So we always try to cycle those reflections and PDCA and look at other models that might be coming along the way with other factories. And so it's nonstop.
Mm-hmm. We're down to probably the last question here, but Andy G wrote in to ask, is this a North American specific Accord, or will it be offered or made in Asia like the previous model?
So we are, we do have a factory in China that will make a China version of the Accord, and that'll launch maybe 6 months, 8 months later. But right now, all the Accords in North America are built here. Then they haven't really announced the exports where we'll be exporting to, but right now, China, we're the global lead. Mm-hmm. So actually, China will learn from us our struggle points or so forth. So we're in constant communication.
Is the China Accord pretty much the same as the North
American? It looks like it's pretty much the same. I'm sure there's some differences for the China market that I'm not aware of. But most places.
So as the lead, I mean, so are people from the China plant embedded in Marysville, or are people from Marysville going to be going to China?
Since it was designed in Japan, there was some interaction with some key members from China. We did have a group of China associates mm-hmm. that came to our factory when we first started building some test units. But we're in constant communication as far as giving information and so forth so that they have a successful launch.
Mm-hmm. So, real good. Look, we're going to have to wrap up this segment, but Don, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
We're going to free you up so you can go back to the plant and build
more. Yeah, you got a lot of cars to build.
All right, thank you.
Thanks very much. We're going to take a quick break right now and give a shout-out to our good friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Whether it's on television, online, or through social media, AutoLine knows how to effectively get your marketing message to the people you want to reach. Contact Stacy Eamon today. There's only one talk show that covers the issues and executives that drive the auto industry. Turn to AutoLine this week, every Friday at AutoLine.tv or on your local PBS stations across America. AutoLine this week. You can't get more inside the industry.
Okay, we're back. And those of you watching on the video version now are going to go, what the heck is going on? John's got a cowboy hat and a big mustache. Gary has got some sort of doctor's outfit with a stethoscope and some sort of reflective mirror.
We can't see the name.
Anyway, and I'll get to that in a minute. Sharon's wearing a witch's hat, and that's because Carmen and Katie came up with the idea that if enough of you out there retweeted a tweet about us having a Halloween motif, we would have to dress up in Halloween costumes. And you all did that, and here we are wearing the costume. And I have to add that Gary is wearing a doctor's outfit because he is Dr. Data, and it's got to be that part of the show where we bring up the number.
Okay, so this one is, I was quite surprised at this number. And so we have Sharon from Automotive News here, so she may guess what this has to do with. But Carmen, please bring the first number up. Okay, so we have two numbers here. So it's 19,927,614 and 19,775,161. Okay, so these two numbers are a measure of something.
Okay, you want to take a guess?
Oh, we're supposed to be. Yeah. Oh, boy. No, I have no idea. So
I'm going to take a stab at it. 19 million something or other could be total production for North America. And maybe one number is last year and the other is a projection for this year?
No. So I'll give you another clue to this one. Okay. It has to do with sales for the first three quarters of the year.
So is it sales for the first three quarters of the year?
There's something about these numbers.
If it's first three quarters, then I would guess maybe
through September, sales through September.
China's numbers.
So both of them are China's numbers.
Okay.
That's what your guess is.
That's what my guess is. Okay.
So
I'll say the top number is North America production and the bottom number is China production.
Okay, then we're going to get the surprising part. So Carmen, bring up the next one. That is the number of light vehicles sold in China through September of this year.
19.9 million.
19.9 million. Okay.
Okay.
So what would the second number have been, the 19.775, et cetera, et cetera, be? And this is where it gets very surprising.
Let's bring it up.
So that is the number. So you have to combine the United States, Canada, Japan, and Korea, and it's still less
than China.
Yow.
So when you think about, you know, we sometimes hear about the importance of the China market. I mean, isn't it incredible that that one country outsells four countries, including the United States?
Yeah. And not only that, the U.S. and Japan would be the second and third largest markets in the world. So number two and three put together still don't match number one.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
So I think, you know, the question becomes as we go forward, I mean, will automakers pay more attention to that market singularly?
They already are.
But I mean, even to a greater extent.
But I guess it depends on how profitable that number is. You know,
that's a good point, Sharon.
I mean, U.S. is still just
way more profitable.
Way more profitable.
Mm-hmm.
We spend a lot of money on our cars, you know, so who knows?
Yeah.
You know, I still think you can't ignore the U.S.
No, that's a great point. You know, I'm trying to remember the numbers, you know, GM reported earnings for North America. What was it? $10 billion? Anyway, the number is coming out of China, and GM sells more cars in China than anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
They make a fraction of the money in China that they do in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's pretty much true for everyone else, too. Okay, Gary, what else should we be talking about in this segment?
That came with a big surprise to me. So this week... I'm going to lose this thing. This is sort of crushing my brain.
I know. The mustache is getting in my way, too.
So this week, Ford announced changes among its executive ranks, which I found to be somewhat surprising. And according to Ford, this was designed to support redesigned organizational structure and focus on fitness. Fitness seems to be the new word that is very popular at Ford now. I'd never really heard that before. Did you hear fitness
no,
is related to
I like
any corporation?
Fit. Yeah.
And seems very strange.
Weightlifting, maybe?
So our friend Kumar Galhotra is now in charge of Lincoln and is in charge of global marketing, which seems somewhat strange to me. So in the marketing function, his focus includes shifting investments toward product categories that play to the company's strengths and developing more effective brand communications, including digital services, e-mobility, and autonomy. So the e-mobility and autonomy part seems to me to be like a big undertaking.
Yeah.
On its own, yet he's also got to run Lincoln. So does this portend something about Lincoln, or maybe make it such that Lincoln isn't quite as important as it might have been, I don't know, 2 months ago?
Great question. You know, this is no question at all a huge promotion for Kumar. I mean, they really see a lot in this guy. But I think your point is really good, Gary. There's no way he can do both these jobs and really put the effort into both that is needed. And all the growth is going to come in the new position he got. Who's number two at Lincoln? Because it looks to me like whoever that executive is really going to be running Lincoln.
Yeah, I don't know.
I have no clue who's number two at Lincoln.
And so, you know, there was that change earlier this year where Joe Heinrichs basically became the guy who was running all of manufacturing globally, and then that Jim Farley would be running all of marketing globally. And so I think that they're beginning to put their imprint on things. One thing that really also surprised me is Benny Fowler, who had been the group vice president of quality and new product launch, he has elected to retire. And these numbers I found to be absolutely astonishing. I mean, if I were doing a Dr. Data thing, I mean, these numbers would just fit right in. He was responsible for launching over 900 vehicles, 163 powertrain programs, and 19 plants around the world.
Wow.
I mean, that's just incredible.
That'll kill you. And this is probably why he was ready to retire.
Yeah. At age 61.
Yeah. Sharon, what do you make of the changes at Ford? What's your gut feel about what's going on there?
Well, I worked at Yahoo and AOL, which were going through some pretty big changes while I was there. And I think it's a sign that, you know, it's inevitable, first of all, it's going to happen. But, you know, I think the new guy comes in, whoever it is, and just needs to start making assessments on who's on board with their vision and who's not. I don't think it's necessarily... says anything negative about those executives. They just, you know, they might not share the same vision or might not be able to, you know, move fast enough, or you really have to buy into your leader's vision if you're going to be trying to, you know, have a company that's moving fast. Can't have anybody second guessing and sitting around and saying, this is the way we've always done things. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just, my hat wobbles when I shake my head. But yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, I could totally see the need to get, make sure that you have everybody on your team moving in line and everybody moving in one direction. So it seems to me that that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah, and I wonder, you know, Jim Hackett, the CEO now, must be really laying out some markers in terms of where they want to be going. Because I was also surprised to see that John Cassessa, who had been the group vice president of global strategy, is gone from the company. You know,
he was really a Mark Fields guy.
Yeah, he was a Mark Fields guy. Yeah. And that's what I wonder too, of the people who are electing to retire, how many of them were aligned with Mark Fields. And the feeling was, we got to get them out of here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So do you think they'll be joining Mark at that private equity firm that he's decided
to
go to?
Yeah.
Okay, we got a question here from Quang Nguyen, who wants to know, can you explain, I'm going to throw this in your lap here, Sharon. Sure. Can you explain why profits are so much higher in North America than China? Is it because they're buying cheaper budget cars with lower profit margins?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. I think in China still they don't really use leasing and loans the way that we do in the U.S. And so we are more highly leveraged society. Like, we'll borrow a lot more to buy what we want. And so, you know, they have to sort of stay within their budget because they're still a very cash-based society. And I don't know if that necessarily means that the cars are cheaper per se, but they might not buy as frequently. They might not turn their cars over every 3 to 5 years like we do tend to do here. And, you know, you have to be in a joint manufacturing agreement. You can't just go into China and start making your own car. And so you have to go in and have a deal with somebody else. And I don't know what that does to your profit margins.
Well,
you know?
I'll tell you, it cuts them in half because you do a 50-50 joint venture or 49-51 or something like that. So half your profits go to your partner. And so that cuts them in half. But, you know, I was using GM as an example earlier. Even if GM built everything and didn't have to share, it still makes a fraction of what it makes here. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of it does have to do with it, to the questioner's question. They sell a lot of cheap vans, like these little Wuling vans that cost maybe $7,000-$8,000. You're just not going to make much money on them.
Right.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, so Ford reported its earnings today, and if you look at those numbers, I mean, the F-150 really held strong in North America. I mean, it would seem to me that, you know, absent F-150, I think that those guys would have a serious issue on their hands.
Oh, they would.
Yeah, and we practically live in our cars here, right? So, mm-hmm. like, your car's got to be kind of like your living room. And
right.
So you're willing to, I think people are willing to pay a lot of money just to be comfortable and hang out in their cars, you know? And you don't see that elsewhere in the world.
Right. And, you know, in the margins, as we've talked on the show many times before, of you know, SUVs, I mean, they're making a lot of dough on those.
Well, yeah, look, China's an important market. China buys more luxury cars than anywhere else. And if, as an automaker, you decide to import a car to China, you can keep all the profit. Now, your car also gets hit with a 25% import tariff, but the Germans and Jeep and Cadillac made good money shipping cars to China that they didn't have to share any profit on. But now, as they're manufacturing more and more in China, those cars are becoming prohibitively expensive because of that tax. Okay, we have a question I want to go back to on the Honda Accord. Wright Knight is looking at that rear quarter window, and he says, does a side glass truly droop downward towards the rear, or is it an optical illusion? And that's a good question. So they have a little chrome trim bit that's on the very edge of that quarter window that makes it look like it droops a whole lot more than it does. But it's a little styling trick that they've used to break up some of the mass on the sail panel there.
Yeah, but it's not a perfect triangle. It's definitely swooping down a bit.
Down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. You did a nice job with the styling on this.
Very swoopy.
Okay, Gary, I know you got more on your list that we got to get to, but before we do that, we got to take another quick break right now, and we got to give a shout out to our good friends at Bridgestone. So, Gary, what else is on your list?
Well, before we get off the truck-ish subject, so yesterday on Daily, you had a fascinating thing where you showed a chart of vehicles that are, you know, the most popular vehicles in different countries around the world.
Right, yeah.
And I thought that was pretty impressive. And one thing caught my eye, which I just find to be astonishing. So the Toyota Hilux.
The pickup truck,
the one that was the subject of the famous Top Gear show back in 2010 of, you know, kill this Hilux, or they're trying to break the thing, and they couldn't do it. I was looking at that world map and kept seeing the name Hilux. So this is where the Hilux is the number one selling vehicle around the world, and it's amazing.
Let's hear it.
Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Paraguay, Argentina, Liberia, Cameroon, Uganda, Botswana, Namibia, South Africa, Mozambique, Kenya, Sudan, Oman, Laos, Australia, Samoa, and Fiji. I mean, this thing is clearly the number one, you know, in terms of countries.
Number of countries, right.
It's just amazing.
Yeah, I wish they had given the volume on that, because
right.
Those are all very small markets. But you're right. It's the Hilux is the number one selling vehicle in more countries
right.
than any other vehicle.
That's just crazy. Yeah, I mean, really. and the thing of it is that, you know, you look at many of these places and you realize that those things must get the hell beat out of them just on a daily basis.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, but you probably can fix it with duct tape and, you know, a plastic bag.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So to go to the other extreme, so this week, Delphi bought this Boston-based company, Newtonomy, which was a spin-out from MIT that was created in 2013, which basically this outfit is running a driverless taxi test in Singapore. They're doing a pilot program with Lyft in Boston, and they have a technical alliance with Peugeot. And so I started looking at what Delphi is up to. So here we have, you know, a traditional tier one supplier that had been spun off, basically the components division of General Motors, what would be about 15 years ago?
2002, I think it was.
Yeah, so 15 years ago. And so just in recent times here, it has made an announcement that it's working with BlackBerry QNX for faltering software performance, and these guys are working together. It has a commercial partnership with LetterTech, a low-cost LiDAR solution, and it made a minority investment. A commercial partnership with Innovez Technologies, also for LiDAR, and they made a minority investment. They're doing a thing with Transdev, a French company that provides mobility services, and this is a partnership to develop a global, fully automated mobility on demand transport system. They also have signed a commercial partnership with Otomo, a data marketplace for automakers, which basically will you buy this stuff from them, and it will provide you all of the information, the data that you've talked about being so important, and they made a minority investment in that. I'm just like, you know, and that's just recently.
Yeah.
I mean, what the heck is going on?
Well, Delphi's always been sort of, well, not always, but since the spinoff, they've been trying to, you know, get different, right? They were doing medical supply stuff for a while, and I mean, I guess maybe they still are, but, you know, they've always been branching out, and mm-hmm. obviously they've realized, you know, that the world is changing, and the world is changing fast, and they need to be a part of it.
Yeah, that's right, and, you know, they're going to split the company into two, and Delphi is going to be Old Co.,
right.
if you will, and this name Aptiv that they're choosing is going to be the New Co., and the new co is going to be all about this autonomy and connectivity and sharing and whatnot. And they're doing that, of course, because Wall Street loves this stuff. That's where the growth is going to be. And it's just fascinating how Delphi is trying to position itself as a dominant supplier of everything to do with it. And what was the one company, Transdev?
Yeah.
Keep an eye on that. This is a fleet management company out of France.
Mm-hmm.
And they may be the biggest in the world or one of the biggest in the world. None of us in the auto industry have ever heard of Transdev before. These guys could emerge as a mega player in the automotive industry as we go to more of this ride sharing and car sharing.
Yeah, the plan between Delphi and Transdev, they're planning on having the first EU driverless on-demand mobility service on an open road, and they're going to do this in France.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, these small buses that take people around, sort of like the Ollie that we saw, was it last year or 2 years ago in L.A.?
Last year.
That Local Motors was doing. I thought it was interesting that this guy who was one of the co-founders of Newtonomy, he had an interview with Alan Ownsman of Forbes, and this is the IAGMA, I'm mispronouncing the guy's name badly, but he says, quote, "I don't believe there'll be a single winner in this space." So it's like he has this notion that there'll be, you know, various companies that are making these developments, and there isn't going to be one solution. And it sort of seemed to me that that, you know, Sergio had basically been indicating, like, you know, we'll wait, and when, you know, the cream rises to the top, we'll just skim it off then. And this seems to run counter to that sort of thinking, that he's basically saying, you know, it's going to be very specific. There'll be, you know, winners here, winners here, winners here, but not one that's going to rake in the whole pot.
Yeah, well, look, I think, you know, who's ever first to the market as an automaker with a truly autonomous car, level 4, level 5, is going to have a massive market advantage. And I think there are going to be different systems. And, you know, the argument will be, my car is more autonomous than your car. And whoever can deliver that, like I say, whose autonomous car can drive across the field to get to the tailgate party at the football game? That's going to be the true measure of autonomy. Can your car do that? And I think there's going to be winners and losers in this, absolutely. And those that have got really robust, truly safe level 4 and level 5 autonomous systems are going to have a big advantage over those who go, well, it's pretty good, but maybe not that good.
Mm-hmm.
See, I think there's a chance that there's going to be some significant losers, too, in, you know, the way you're sort of talking about this and the different things that they've invested in makes me think, well, how do you figure out if you're a traditional automaker and right now you're basing your success on how many cars you sell? How do you figure out success in a world like this? Like, the auto industry really needs to start really radically reconsidering how they monetize what they're doing. You know, I mean, like, you think about a sort of cell phones. Like, if you had a car and you bought the car like you bought your iPhone, but then you were paying for the services of different things. You paid for the autonomous service, you know, on demand when you wanted it, or maybe when you didn't want it, and, you know, or you paid for your car on demand. Like, all that stuff is, like, it's almost kind of crazy. Like, you need to figure out, how are you going to tell people, yeah, this is working and we're making money at it? Or even for yourselves, like, figure out how you're going to make money at it. Because there's only, you can invest in these companies for a long time, for a while, but at some point, you know, you need to show it with success.
No, I totally agree with you, and you raise a really good point. Using the phone analogy, who's making money on smartphones? Not so much the people who are manufacturing the smartphones. They're not losing money, but they're not making the big money. It's the companies that design the operating system, and it is the service providers, the AT&Ts, the Verizons, and the like. Those are the companies that are making big money off smartphones.
Right.
And that's the danger that the automotive industry faces. It will make the cars, but the real profit is going to be in the fleet management and the data monetization.
Right.
Will they play a role in that?
Yeah, I mean that's sort of what kind of killed Mark Fields, right? He was so worried about not becoming a cell phone supplier that he really wasn't able, and didn't kill him, obviously, but kind of pushed out of the industry. You know, he was so focused on that he wasn't taking enough risks. And yeah, I think that you have to think about that as it is definitely a risk, but the way to play in that game is not to ignore it. It's to, you know, do more of what Delphi is doing, like,
yeah,
get your hand in everything.
It's sort of interesting that, I mean, we're hearing this from Delphi. So that company, made the minority investment in and has a commercial partnership agreement, the Autotomo. It's a connected car marketplace, seamlessly and securely connects car data from any OEM to service and application providers such as insurance, fleet transportation, vehicle repair services, emergency services, and expense control apps.
Yeah.
So basically, it's getting what you're talking about, all this information that has value.
Yeah.
And then you know, and you know, because Delphi also has, you know, the over-the-air
capability, right? And you know, it has a Movemento that it bought that company. Right. It was last year,
right?
So we didn't count that one. So you know, so here's a supplier that you know has historically been making, you know, stuff, you know, gears and condensers and
injectors
and, right. And whatnot. It's basically looking and doing exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And so do you think that it's just the nature of a supplier that can do that more rapidly than an OEM?
Maybe. I mean, I've heard, you know, traditional companies say we need to sort of behave like a startup.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they do anything but behave like a startup. You know, they make big investments and then they just sort of suck the life out of them.
Mm-hmm.
It would be interesting. You know, I think you can make investments and then if you... But you can also kill them pretty quickly, you know. So I don't know, you know, by making the investments, if that actually is necessarily means that they're going to be successful at this, they have to let these companies continue to experiment and invest. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
one of the things that makes startups so awesome is that
right.
they have this flexibility to, you know, change on a dime, which mm-hmm. you just don't get in a big corporate
right.
environment.
If it doesn't work, they close and go down the street and
yeah,
another one.
Exactly,
right.
exactly. And they, you know, headcount, for example, you know, if they need to hire 10 people, they'll just hire 10 people. You know, you can't do that in a traditional corporate environment. You have to get the headcount approved and figure out how are you going to budget it and, you know, all of that stuff that just mm-hmm. slows everything down.
Right.
So that's the danger in this, too, is that you can sort of slow all this innovation down. Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I really respect with Delphi, soon to be Aptiv, they've put together a strategy like nobody else has. And in addition to everything else that you mentioned, Gary, you know, they're part of this consortium that involves Intel and Mobileye. Aren't they part of the BMW thing, too?
Yeah, it begins to seem like everybody's part of that because we had Magna on last week on the show. Yeah. Swami was on there, and they're doing that with the same companies. And so there's a lot of these guys that are all doing the same thing. Speaking of consortium, so this is the last quote from this guy, the Iga Nema, the co-founder. And this is a quote. In the automotive domain, generally speaking, when you look at consortium models, the groups that have leading technology are less incentivized to contribute to the consortia. There's a potential end state where you have participants that are not market leaders, and with a large field of participants that aren't leaders, there's no guarantee that just by combining resources, they end up with a winning solution.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds like heresy.
Yeah,
that
guy is. Wow, that's a great quote.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
For this guy to be rolling out and saying that, it's like,
yeah.
Yikes.
Okay,
yeah.
Look. We're getting down to the end of the show here. We got a number of questions that came in from viewers. Let's hit them rapid fire. I'm just going to wait to throw them out at you. This is a good one for you, Gary. Andy G says, does the Kobe Steel scandal have any direct effect on the safety of vehicles? Aren't vehicles crash tested?
My understanding of that is that the companies that were using that steel looked at it and they've come out and said that it is not a problem. I just find it to be like very bizarre that, you know, Kobe Steel was gaming their quality control and that just seems crazy. I mean, for that to have happened.
Yeah, it is pretty insane.
Well, you know, it's, you know, Takata, you know, faked their safety testing and
right.
blah, blah, blah. This is just more of it. Somebody runs into a problem. They don't want to piss off the boss, and they just go, this is good, and let it, you know, go through.
Well, one thing that hasn't been talked about very much is that Nissan in Japan had a problem in terms of, you know, had to close down plants for a couple of weeks because it's quality reporting, because apparently the government is very deeply involved in certifying the production quality of vehicles, not, you know, I mean, literally in the plant sort of qualification.
Right.
And I guess that those books were being cooked.
Okay, this one goes to you, Sharon. Whip Good wants to know, whatever happened to the wave of dechroming vehicles?
Oh, boy. I have no idea.
I can tell you what happened. You know, they were dechroming or blacking stuff out, and then all of a sudden, I think it was Audi went back to a chrome DLO, and everybody went, wow, that looks pretty good, and chrome has been making a little bit of a comeback. You know, it's not like it was in the 50s or 60s.
It's being done tastefully, I think.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
it may have gone overboard. And, I mean, as we look at this Accord, I mean, there's chrome on it, but it isn't garish.
Yeah, and it's not as much in the interiors anymore either, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not blinded when you're going down the road,
right?
Which is nice.
So here's more of a comment. Michael Shipley says, Ford should bring back Fields and let them run Lincoln. That's
never
going to happen.
For a number of reasons.
Dan Albert says he looked at that same map that you were talking about, Gary, and he assumes that they're new cars, but he wants to know, do these countries not get hand-me-downs from the U.S. and other developed markets? That used to happen.
Yeah.
There are still some markets that, well, look, the Hilux is a pretty primitive truck.
Right.
Which is one reason why it's so robust. You know, there's no advanced technology on it like you get on probably a Tacoma or anything like that. But, you know, the hand-me-down, that's pretty much gone by the wayside. You know, that was very typical up through the 70s.
Yeah, I don't think if you go to a developing country right now, you find a whole lot of black and white TVs and dial telephones. I mean, I think that they've sort of leapt up to where the West is.
Yeah, and I think that was much more of an issue, too, when the dollar was stronger, right? Because then it made it much cheaper. Am I thinking that right? So I remember we sold a Toyota to a couple that were sending it to Russia. And I remember the dollar was really strong. There was something in it. Like, it makes a lot more sense.
Well, the dollar being strong would hurt, but
okay.
The U.S. has the cheapest car prices in the world. We have the lowest taxes and import duties on them. And so, yeah, we got cheap cars.
Right.
Cheap price-wise.
Right.
Okay, one last one. Pedro Alexander wants to know, how are sales going for Alfa Romeo in the U.S. this year with the Giulia and Stelvio?
Well, I mean, obviously they're improving, but I mean, I don't know that anybody's going to be uncorking the Chianti and having celebrations about how many vehicles are selling.
I don't know the numbers off the top of my head. Stelvio is still not really available across the country.
So this is
percentage-wise, it should look good.
So this is through September. They have sold 6,410 Giulias. They have sold 309 4Cs, which is down 25%, and they have sold 633 Stelvios. And I think the first full month might have been September, and they sold 329. I mean, so, you know what? They have a grand total of 7,352 vehicles sold in the United States in the first 9 months, which is a 1,659% increase. So
percentage-wise
they're through the roof.
Numbers are still pretty small.
Yeah.
I sold almost as many cars as that this year.
Okay, I can't close out the show without mentioning our work wrote in and said, Hilux, what percentage are sold with the 50 millimeter mounted in the bed?
Yes.
Because there is, you know, the technicals, as they call them, a lot of those are Hiluxes. And then one last comment here. Kevin Hissel said, by the way, I love Autoline After Hours. Have not missed a single show, single all caps. And that's almost 400 of them, right?
Wow.
So, all right, Kevin, we love you. But with that, we're going to have...
I want to know how you shaved so quickly. You went from a mustache to...
Well, you know, this is the magic of video production.
Of Halloween.
Yeah. So, Sharon Carty, thanks so much for stopping by. Always good to have you on the show. Gary, this was a lot of fun. I love the Halloween motif.
It's great. It's fantastic.
And, of course, want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
I may wear this every week.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai, better drives us.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.